Session number two on death, and it is Good Friday, 1983. Two words I wanted to make sure were precise about our meaning from yesterday. One is animal and one is death. So I'll start with the one on animal. Sometimes we say to somebody, you're acting like an animal. You know, or if somebody is immoral, we say you're acting like an animal. And Karen brought this up, that why don't you just share your feeling about that from seeing Gandhi, would you?
Well, there was a theme in Gandhi where the Indians wanted to be able to make salt. There was a monopoly on the production of salt by the British. And the Indians walked forth in a very peaceful manner without any weapons. Slowly, there were maybe four or five together walking forth to get to the sea, or to get to the area where the salt was to be made. And they were just beaten with clubs in the head. The people would walk forth and the British would stand there, and I don't just say British to downgrade the British, I think this is part of our human nature as well, but would just beat them and prevent them from going forth any further. And it just was, to say this was animal behavior, I think is doing an injustice to animals. I think that was human behavior. In the movie, it said that was the day when the British let go of India because of their total loss of moral responsibility, just their horrible behavior. Another example was in Shantung Compound. Selfishness came out, there was a shortage of food, and the people would just guard the food and not share it in any way. And Gilkey, the author, said at first he thought this was animal behavior, and then he realized, no, this is not animal behavior, this is human behavior, to have to hoard and guard and really hurt other individuals, to be so concerned and anxious about the future that other people must go hungry in order that we can not only eat today and eat a lot today, but hoard and hoard and hoard for the future. So to me, it's not fair to accuse the animals of doing this kind of thing.
Karen mentioned this, it reminded me of a poem I read a long time ago, I wish I would have kept, about a monkey, mm-hmm. totally insulted that someone had said that he was related to human beings. Now, it's Karen bringing this up that I wanted to clarify. When we say we are animal, we're not using it morally, like saying animals are immoral and to be animal is to act in a way that's immoral, but we are, it's another way of just saying we are physical, and that we are part of the creation, and it just means everything that it means to be physical, to be born, marked by heredity, dependent on parents. We must eat, find shelter, inhabit space, urinate, defecate, procreate, protect, get sick, have accidents, have limits, live with inner drives, age, die, rot. That's what we mean when we say we are animal. So, is that word clarified? Any other? Okay, the other one is death. Mary brought this up, what do we actually mean by death? Because especially at the time of the arms race, we say we oppose death because the building of this nuclear military machine is the work of death. Or we say that life is full of all kinds of deaths. But when I'm using the word death here, it's related again to also the definition of the animal. It's simply physical death. However, the latest way of defining that, it used to be when you stop breathing, I think the latest definition of, you could maybe help with this, Jim, latest definition of death would be more to do with the brain cells, wouldn't it?
It's still a debatable thing, but they do use brain death. Yet they don't consider that a body death.
So it is a controversy, but at least we know what we mean, that we're not talking about kind of our, like a spiritual deaths, or we're just talking about the end of physical life on this planet. Okay, I think we were responding to yesterday because I got quite a few reports that you were contemplating your humanity yesterday in different ways.
Dan, one thing occurred to me yesterday when you made a point about people dying alone, and people will be with them and then they just leave and they die. I think maybe some of that has to do with our not letting them die. When my mother was dying, I kept trying to hold on to her and to keep her living, and she finally said to me, if you won't help me in the dying, you're going to have to leave. So I had to come to her.
The part of her.
She let me stay with her because it was.
It's part of our hovering, isn't it? To
not wanting to let go.
Yeah. Another thing, have you noticed how we tend to say to a person in grief right after death, are you okay? Or, oh, an okay means you're not crying. And we have, all of these different avoidance. Yes, Mary.
I have a problem with wanting to deny death, or not maybe deny is the word that I shouldn't use, but I want to fight for life till I can't anymore. The daily deaths, which many of them to me are opposites of celebration of life, and the final death, biblically, I mentioned that last night, that it's the final enemy. And there's a difference between looking forward to, I don't even know the two words I want to use. I will fight death till I can't fight it anymore. And I think that's how human beings survive. Is there not wanting to accept that? Or why would we have research and the human spirit be so amazing in the face of terrible tragedy and things that happen?
Yeah, I think most of the session today will be on that. You can tell me at the end if it answered it a little. About how do we relate, to death? How does the accepting of our death help us to live? Is there a point when we don't fight death anymore? How is death the enemy? Because I think the biblical faith calls death the enemy. We take death very seriously. We don't. The Greeks had a way of kind of smoothing over death by talking about a soul that lives on forever. It was a way of kind of telling yourself that you really don't die. And the biblical Hebrew Christian faith takes death very seriously as the end. It's terror. It is the end. Resurrection says something else, but we don't. Well, I won't get into that too much, but you see how the understanding of a soul inside of you that lives on after your body dies is a way of somehow making it smoother.
Are you going to talk about the immortality of the soul?
I hadn't planned on it, but I'll just mention that right now. And I would say it is another death denying as a book, The Denial of Death, probably one of the strongest death denying, I don't know what word to use, mechanisms, is the belief in the immortality of the soul. And that is that somehow inside of me I have something called a soul that doesn't die when I die and that lives on forever. And therefore that makes death very, or rather, what would I say, unserious matter. It's a typical funeral. A little joke was a preacher at a funeral pointed to the body in the casket and said, don't think of this as Joe, This is only the shell and the nut has gone home. You get the, in other words, there is a part of Joe that never died but just kind of flew out of his body and lives on forever. And there, the New Testament has some, uses that symbol somewhat to affirm continuity of existence, but the overpowering New Testament understanding of death is that when you are dead, you are dead. You know, deader than a doornail, as we would say. You are finished. It's the end. And that the then the marvelous celebration of Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 of the resurrection is that when we die in total trust that God will bring forth a resurrection. And what it means, we go into death with absolutely nothing, taking absolutely nothing. And so we die as we live in complete trust. Is that a new idea to any of you? Or no?
In answer to Mary's question there, too, I didn't understand your answer, or to add on to it, I think from personal experience in dealing with dying patients, my mother, for one, who I was there, did not want to, said, I want to die. She had bronchiectasis and difficult breathing, and a lot of complications resulted from it. And literally fought death right up until the very, very last breath, and kept saying, I want to die. Oh, just pray for me that I'll die. Yet, in the next minute, clinging, I don't want to die. This has been classical of a lot of other people. She was more personal in her relationships to me and conveyed this. But in clergymen who felt that same way, only maybe expressed it a little differently, and people who were of no denomination, they had that same feeling. I think basically everyone does not want to die. I don't think you have, even the strongest Christian to the weakest atheist, many of them don't. I hear the extremes that you mention occasionally, but I think the norm is that everyone is afraid to die.
Do you agree, Muslim?
In the sense of the world.
Yeah, as I can only speak for myself that I want to live. And I'll cling to life and affirm life. I guess it's a true story of the old revival preacher, Billy Sunday. Was that his name?
Yes.
Just preached this powerful sermon about the wonders and glories of heaven, where we'll go when we die, and just painted this rosy picture of the wonders of heaven. And right at the end of the sermon, he had a heart attack. And they all rushed around him, and he said, "Get me to Rochester." So they rushed him to Mayo Clinic immediately, to revive him. And somebody just said, "You had your chance and you didn't want it." I think that does that underscore, I think, what
you... Exactly.
Mother Teresa's brother was dying, and she was consoling him with the same thing. "Oh, I envy you. You're going to be with Jesus and everything." He said, "Well, if you're so envious, take my place."
Mary?
I'm one believer in this, but I just think the first time I realized, not too many years ago, that immortality of the soul is not a Christian doctrine, I was really shocked, because that's what I had been taught, or somehow, and it seems logical if we think of, in our Greek thinking, we divide body, mind, and spirit, that when we die, we also divide it, so that our body dies, but our spirit doesn't. And I don't think people that I've talked to are always very surprised to think that isn't very scriptural.
Yeah. How did you feel? Was that a surprise,
Janet? I wanted to get back to that, because if this isn't part of the session, I think I need to talk about it some other time.
Oh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about a few minutes. There's some stuff I want to kind of wrap up from yesterday. share what you're thinking. Should we put a time on this? But because if it is a real concern, I think it'd be good for another session too, but let's handle it for a few minutes. Do you want to share what your...
Well, my reaction is, well, why did I go out to all those funerals? I mean, that's what they always say. I mean, it does kind of blow some of the stuff I've been thinking for a while. Maybe I'm not hearing the words, or maybe Mary's saying the same thing I believe and think, but it's different words or something, but I, yeah.
Yeah, it's, I think we have to admit it's a typical funeral sermon.
Yeah.
You know, that Joe here, you know, his body has died, but his soul is going to heaven.
Yeah. With Jesus and with all the relatives and...
Yeah.
One time in our discussion about the phrase, take up your cross and follow me, leading to that's my cross to bear. Do you remember in the first four sessions? And Yoder makes the point that the theology of some problem that you have, some physical ailment, some irritation that's daily, the way our theology gets shaped and someone else says to you, that's your cross to carry, is because somebody wants to say something helpful, almost be your counselor, and so they use bad theology for a good purpose, meaning that's part of the price of being Christian and what have you, but if you think through, that's not what it is biblically. I think some of those funeral sermons are for the same reason. I remember one of the ones, it was a very small child that died in the parish where I belonged, and I heard someone say to the mother, God needed a small child's voice in the heavenly choir. That's why this baby died. First of all, I thought it was very poor theology, but the idea that our loved one is still consciously alive with Jesus seems to reassure people, or it comes as a word of comfort. So I think that's why, and many of the hymns, any of the things that we say to people and sing about and say at the funeral are Greek immortality of the soul, not biblical, I believe, in the resurrection of the body. The funeral should do a couple things. It should give thanks for the life. Should be a time of the human response of grief. And should say, Jesus is Lord.
And I'd add, too, that it'd be a funeral, I would think, too, is a celebration of the resurrection.
It's not Christian not to want to die, in other words. Right?
Yeah, it's not.
It is not. You cannot say. I think this was a fear of a lot of people, that if I'm afraid to die,
yeah,
I'm not a Christian.
Paul. It, you know, the resurrection of the body adds even more terror in some ways to death, because it means that when I'm on my deathbed, I have to go into death with total trust that I'm going to lose everything, and that I trust only in the promise of the resurrection. You know, that God's promise that I believe to make all things new. You know, that it...
Is the question kind of like the question from Advent? What are we waiting for anyways? We have no idea of, no capability of being able to conceptualize what we're talking about.
Yeah. And the latest books that are out on like life after life and all that are, you know, it's part of our, I think, our need to get, take our science into the afterlife and assure ourselves that somehow it's...
Is the difference between resurrection of the body and immortality of the soul, the difference between a continuity in time or the immortality doctrine and a stopping and a later resumption of something else in the Christian doctrine? And if the only difference is one of time, time's only a human invention anyway and is really quite irrelevant.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is another way that we really die in mystery and in trust. But what's important is that you know, the doctrine of the immortality of the soul is just carries on a doctrine that when it is lived in this life, has all the problems of separating sacred from secular, soul from body, downgrading of the physical, unimportance of nature. Yeah, Jim.
Sometimes I'm affected by that familiar approach, by their fruits you shall know them. Let me sketch out one of my favorite poets that I'm sure most of you have never heard of, Edwin Muir. He was a Scottish boy from the Orkney Isles, very, very poverty-stricken. He came down to Glasgow and was immediately in the slums. And he became first a communist, then a democratic socialist, then a follower of Nietzsche. And during the beginning of the Second World War, when he was quite well informed of the German prison camps and the atrocities committed by our side as well, he was riding the riding a streetcar, and he looked at people as animals. He says, through their eyes, I saw pigs and beasts and devouring carnivorous creatures. One night, he said, I was dressing to go out to dinner, and suddenly the Lord's Prayer came to me unwillingly. And he said, I realized it for the first time in 25 years that I was a Christian. And he said, I cannot write as a poet, I cannot survive as a man without seeing human beings as immortal beings. He says, I want no scientific or theological proof, but I must somehow reduce the vicious animal that I see lurking behind the human face. The human face, he said, is like a calm sea, but below it are carnivorous creatures like in the ocean, devouring each other endlessly. And I find that attractive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I have to say I do too.
What is one, I'm not sure Bill and Janet were asking the same thing, but there is a promise of resurrection of the body, new heaven, new earth. So you can talk at a funeral about the promises, the point, and I continuity or new maybe is a way to get at it. But my understanding of immortality of the soul in a Greek concept is no matter what God does or doesn't do, there's some part of me which is indestructible. Mm-hmm. And I kind of hang on to that. Resurrection of the body says death is death, and anything after that is another act of God, like God created, God will recreate. So I really have more trust, I have to trust more. The other is even God can't destroy this immortal soul that will go on, and so I put my hopes in some quality that I now have rather than an act of God. So if there is a, I think there's more than just the time factor there. Okay, that's why I said to say Jesus is Lord at the funeral and to look toward resurrection is placing your trust in the God of life and the God of your death. You really can't say a lot more beyond that, you know.
But we don't have the words.
No, it's mystery, and it's also a way of placing our whole understanding of grace into our understanding of death. Mary, did
you? Well, you know, I was just going to say practically the same thing. To me, it's more than, it's not a time lag. It's that we are going to be created new creatures and raised as new creatures.
Well, we can
I would just like to respond to what Jim said again. I think we have a peculiarly human nature that does lead us to devour one another, but I cannot reduce that to, and I say reduce, I don't mean that. I cannot call that animal behavior. I think we have calculated ways of destroying one another. So to say we're like the creatures in the ocean, like if we eat one another, I still think we do more harm and cause more cruelty than the animals, and it comes from our reason.
Yeah. Or I think I'd say it comes from the bending of our spirit that is you know, our, as we said, our human dilemma.
Right.
That we're, we're physical and spirit.
I guess I have some questions then about the whole concept within Catholic theology of praying to saints as intercessory prayer. Then does that blow that completely out?
If they are
as dead as we are going to be dead, they were as human as we are human, then there's no, I mean, Christ is the only one that has been raised in his new body, in the new whatever. So what is the sense of praying to someone who, you know, what does it say to them?
Yeah, I guess the question behind that wouldn't only be saints, but do people who have died exist?
Well, according to what you said, no, there is no consciousness. There is nothing.
I think we have, as the New Testament witnesses to this, that we're surrounded by the great cloud of witnesses of those who have gone before us. You know, you have to start by placing all of that in the realm of total mystery. But also, we don't organize the way this happens. So, a sense of fellowship with the saints is possible in the mystery. I mean, that, in a way we can only use human language and we flounder. But why couldn't a saint already be in the resurrection life? You know, we relegate all of this to mystery anyway. I don't think it's when we have to have it also neatly organized that we run into problems. Don't we have a sense of the saints being real and surrounding us?
But then we're all saints.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, here I guess I'm meaning saints as those who have died.
Yeah. Church triumphant.
Yeah, we say the church triumphant.
Then what is it, a matter of semantics? The immortality and resurrection, you're just changing the word. This is something I hadn't thought about, but it does open up a whole other...
Yeah, it does. It raises a real question. But I don't think what I said gives an answer, and I don't know if we ever would get an answer. We can sure try.
Do people actually pray to saints or pray about saints? Pray to saints?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Tim.
Well, I don't know. No more curious discussion too terribly far, but I hear the Greek notion of spirit and body knocked after death. Mm-hmm. Yet, Dan, in a way, I kind of feel it's ironic that you talk about the individual in your little diagram there, dividing them between spirit and body.
Yes, okay, that's important because when I say, you know, when we say the human dilemma is that I'm physical, but I'm also spirit. I'm not talking about a Greek kind of part of me that's eternal or spiritual. I'm talking about, again, the mystery of the fact that we are physical but have self-consciousness. We have the ability to reason, we have the ability to ask the meaning of life, and finally the ability to pray, and finally the ability to love and to thank God, and you know, that is what I mean by spirit, not a kind of undefinable entity that somehow is part of me. How else do I say it? Do you see the difference between that and the Greek idea of soul?
That's okay. It's okay. I'll talk to you about it.
Okay. Yeah. Greek soul is talking about kind of a spiritual substance that, you know, you can't see, but it's there. Mm-hmm. I'm really lost here in the semantics of it. So, but I do mean something different. Might take me a year to try to explain it. should we move on to where it takes off just where we begin, just a reminder of what we mean by spirit. And this comes again from Reinhold Niebuhr. Spirit would be the same as the image of God. You're created in the image of God. We're created, it almost becomes like what we're created for, and somehow have the capacity for that. And that is to live in conscious harmony with others and God. Notice the emphasis on the word conscious. In order to live in conscious harmony, I am created with self-consciousness. In other words, I can look at myself, I can ask what life is all about, and I can reason to make decisions to live in the conscious harmony with God. Now here Niebuhr makes a faith statement. Psychoanalysts might say that we are a unique combination of nature and self-consciousness. Faith says that self-consciousness is made in order that we may relate to God and to one another consciously in love. Is that straight? Then the juncture, this is a really review from yesterday, of being physical and also having self-consciousness is what creates human anxiety. The fact that not some humans are anxious, but to be human is to be anxious. You see the difference? And then when I can contemplate my existence, I also can know I am going to die. And this means that I look in the mirror and, I noticed this the other day when somebody showed me some pictures of when I was 20. And it really hit me there, I look older. And when I look older, it means I'm closer to death. And those wrinkles and the gray hair and the sinking of different parts of one's body, are just reminders that death is coming. And you can see why the less you are reconciled with death, the more cosmetics become important. The more facial lift operations become important. Do you know what I mean by that? The cosmetic industry just thrives on the fear of death. Yeah.
By reconciliation with death and the acceptance that I'm going to die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The two parts of this anxiety is one, I face my own death, and also because I have self-consciousness, I realize how totally out of control I really am in this world. And I really have little control over what's happening to me and my fate, and I'm just surrounded by the all the accidents and possibilities of accidents of nature. I'm really out of control. And then the fall or the rebellion against this, and Kierkegaard in his commentary on the fall, I think relates is that what I fall to is illusion. I don't fall to kind of a moral, I'm going to start doing naughty things now. But I fall into an illusion, and the illusions are these. The main illusion is, I'll just say the main illusion is control. Somehow now I can find a little area that I can kind of box myself in, and there I can control. And Becker, I think, in different ways calls this the lie. And then within this little area, I have to control, I have to keep things organized, and I have to control other people. And it right away it gives you the radical nature of the Last Supper in our liturgy last night. When Jesus, in all the symbols of the Last Supper, says, be a servant. and the servant is one that has no control over. Then the other part of living in the illusion is the illusion that somehow I can grasp some idol within nature and make that my God, and that will give me fulfillment. And that can be Becker, one quote from Becker, it's a famous quote, "Modern man is drinking and drugging himself out of awareness, or he spends his time shopping," which is the same thing. You've probably heard that quote from Becker. But the drugs, to take a part of nature to somehow find my human joy, or at least protection, or shopping, representing any way that I take a part of nature, one of the functions of nature, whether it's eating, consuming, shelter, clothing, sex, anything, and make that into a God that is going to give me fulfillment. And what this is called is lie. It's called illusion. And we left yesterday with asking the question, are we just part of a cosmic joke? That we are here, we build our little worlds where we can organize things, and then we try to find fulfillment in different ways, and there's no fulfillment whatsoever. Is there a God just sitting up there someplace laughing at the whole thing? Are we part of a cosmic joke? That in short is a human dilemma, and it makes Luther even more relevant. You realize how close Luther is to what we're saying today. That was in a way his discovery. That the human dilemma is not that we're animal-like and physical and we have to reach to become more spiritual. But Luther used, in his words, all of the concepts of that we live in an illusion. We live out of reality, and that is our fall. And the illusion is that somehow I can be the center of everything and build my little organized world. Or the illusion is that I can trust things that are around me to give me fulfillment, and then they don't. And then Niebuhr says that anxiety, and that anxiety produces the attempt for fulfillment. When the fulfillment doesn't come, it produces more anxiety, which produces a greater attempt at fulfillment, which produces more anxiety, and it becomes an endless cycle. And one word to describe it might be hell. So that's really where we're up to where I left off yesterday. Now, I want to, this in a way is a witness now of, it wasn't until I understood the human dilemma, until I really understood in a deep way, and I think I still have a lot to understand, this isn't complete, but the implications of the affirmation in John's Gospel, the Word became animal. I'll use that word as a shocker.
It worked.
What?
I was shocked.
Yeah. God became animal, or as we said yesterday, an animal that shits. No. A God that shits. Or a God worm. Or God becomes a flesh human. And what that means to me in the very depth is not animal, but animal spirit. For God takes upon the very self of God, shares now the human dilemma of the anxiety of being torn between flesh and spirit. And what this is almost too neat that it almost fits my little chart, but how this form of God becoming one with us is a cruciform. And when you think of these days and Good Friday, how The cry of Jesus in Gethsemane was the cry of human possibility. I want to live and I want to reach possibilities. And the cross now that stood before Jesus was the limitation of the null. And then how around him at crucifixion, those who had been the most dear to him now left, those who had provided support now give him maybe his deepest pain, that they leave. They leave him all alone. And the only word that I think that comes to me in a universe that looks like a joke is this, that God becomes flesh. And now, just keep going with this, the implications of this. If God takes on flesh, suffers, and dies, then we have a divine affirmation of life in this world. We have a divine affirmation of human life. And in the deepest sense, the cross means, and Paul Tillich, in a marvelous sermon, just put it this way, you are accepted. You know, and just let that, let the power of those three words just start ringing. You are accepted. And again, once I understand the human dilemma, then the phrase you are accepted even means more. Because where you are and who you are is totally accepted by the divine and affirmed. And it's another very deep way of saying this, that it is now okay to leave behind the illusions and the lies and totally embrace human life on this planet. Somebody put it this way, I didn't write down who, I will take the whole loaf as it comes, hulls and pits, as well as the nutritious parts, and bite into it with all my being. With all my being, I'll bite into it, and I'll eat the whole loaf, and I'll embrace all of life. And we call this the event of grace. And it's, in a way, it's a miracle to be graced. My seminary professor that helped with some of this stuff was Bob Benny. And he told a story about his life just to illustrate this. And he said he went to, well, it was when he was in his 20s. And he had a Rhodes Scholar. He was a top athlete. He had all the possibilities that there are in the world to succeed. He was on his way up the academic ladder, brilliant person, wasn't feeling well, went to the doctor and was diagnosed as terminally ill and had several months to live. Did you ever hear this? Went into despair, you know, and depression. And he said it happened once when he was taking a shower and the water just poured over him in the shower, and all of a sudden he was graced, you might say. And it was almost like the word came, it's all okay, accept it all, embrace life as it is, you know, bite the whole loaf. He said he came out of the shower, everything was the same, he still had the word about what was going to happen to him. He said also everything that was different, been graced. And then story has a good ending. He went back a week later and the doctor apologized, had made the wrong diagnosis, and of course he's still alive. What he said was that the grace did not come when the word of the doctor came that everything was okay, but the grace came at the bottom when somehow the word of God's love and acceptance broke through to him so he could just grasp this whole situation. Now, I want to turn from here for a minute, and then we'll talk about this, is really the Pauline concept of death, because it really fits in exactly here. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, after he's talked about the resurrection, he says, where death is your victory? Where death is your power to hurt? Death gets its power to hurt from sin, and sin gets its power from the law. But thanks be to God who gives us victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Okay, let's kind of pick this apart. Death hurts because of sin. Now, sin is this, I think in Pauline thought, and adult thought. Sin is trusting what will not last forever. Sin is control. And I'm just carrying Pauline thought here into my own words, that you won't find this in the New Testament. Sin is shopping. In other words, sin is the illusion, as I said before, that somehow it's all going to last and it's all going to work. And trusting that somehow fulfillment is going to come in some way. And then the law comes as that consciousness-raising power where I see for these brief moments that this is a lie. That's the coming of the law. So what, if you put it on a chart like this, the terror of death is this, that I live my life with the lie and the illusion. And the law is those moments when I open my eyes and see ahead that physical death is the end. It's the end of all of my attempts to reach fulfillment in my lives. It's the end of all of the illusion that somehow I can get control and be in control. And so therefore death stands as the ultimate threat over my life. Now, if we go back now to Romans 6, Paul says, and he says other places, but when we were baptized, we were buried with Christ and shared the death of Christ. Paul says, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live. What Paul is talking about is the terror of death, which is the end of my illusions and the end of my lies. This terror can be accepted, and I can die long before I die. Do you get it? In other words, to leave the illusions is to die. To accept the judgment of death now, so then the rest of my life can be lived with that judgment instead of that judgment being ahead of me, that judgment being behind. And now what this means then is that this, the sting of death is over. And now if the illusion is that somehow I can leave life in nature, or I can use nature as my God, if this is all over, then what am I free to do and to be but to be exactly what I am? And I'll see if I can explain this. I get a little lost in the words. To be exactly what I am is to be an animal in creation with spirit. I mean, it seems so simple, doesn't it? And the faith statement is that the spirit of me is that I am created to be an animal that lives in relationship to God. And so what the freedom of this death that comes long before we die, what the freedom is, we are not freed from nature to be a spiritual being, but we're freed to be exactly what God created us to be. That is to be an animal that lives with God in relationship and love. And it means receiving the earth as a gift and my body as a gift. And I want to just close, and then we can talk about this a little bit. Something from Anthony Bloom. He's writing to a woman who has a terminal illness and is in despair about it. And he writes to her and says, try to learn humility in the real deep sense of this word. And this, to me, this almost ties it all together. The word humility comes from the Latin word humus, which means fertile ground, earth. To me, humility is not what we often make of it, the sheepish way of trying to imagine that we are the worst of all, and trying to convince others that our artificial ways of behaving show that we are aware of that. Humility is the situation of the earth. The earth is always there, always taken for granted, never remembered, always trodden on by everyone. Somewhere we cast and pour out all the refuse, all we don't need, but it's there, silent and accepting everything in a miraculous way, making out of all that refuse new riches in spite of corruption, transforming corruption itself into a power of life and a new possibility of creativeness, open to the sunshine, open to the rain, ready to receive any seed we sow, and capable of bringing 30-fold, 60-fold, 100-fold out of every seed. And I said to this woman, learn to be like this before God, abandoned, surrendered, ready to receive anything from people and anything from God. I won't read on, but it gives you an idea. Then from Poverty of Spirit, he uses very sexist language, so I didn't have time to change. A man leaves his dreary conceptions aside and focuses on naked poverty. When the masks fall and the core of his being is revealed, it soon becomes obvious that he is religious by nature. The religion is a secret dowry of his being. In the midst of his existence, there unfolds the bond which ties him to the infinitely transcendent mystery of God, the insatiable interest in the absolute that captivates him and underlines his poverty. At the core of his existence is a transcendental neediness. It spurs and supports all his longings and desires, works itself out through them, and is never exhausted by them. When they are fulfilled, it ruthlessly exposes how provincial they are. It condemns man to a restless pilgrimage through the universe in search of a final satisfaction, an amen, which the poor know is theirs only in the kingdom of heaven. St. Augustine said it in the famous quote, we are restless until we find our rest in thee. Well, what do you think?
Can I share something I found in writing last night?
Sure.
I was reading the rhinoceros one again, and I found a paragraph that I thought was death. It is in the desert of loneliness and emptiness that the fear of death and the need for self-affirmation are seen to be illusory. When this is faced, then the anguish is not necessarily overcome, but it can be accepted and understood. Thus, in the heart of anguish, I found the gifts of peace and understanding. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In a way, what this means to me is I'm always going to be anxious and unfulfilled, and I'm always going to be upset and frustrated. I mean, this is true until my dying day. But that word has come, you're loved, you're accepted, it's okay. And then the freedom to kind of be just really what I am and God, what God has created me to be, comes with that.
Isn't it hard to hear that when we have all the illusions? It seems when you were doing that reading, the room goes through, like there are books about loving yourself, but how can you do it when you have all of the barriers and illusions?
Because the illusion, I think, would lead to self-hatred. Because then we're beating ourselves because we're not fulfilling ourselves. And our very possibilities that we grasp for aren't working.
Depends on what kind of mood I'm in. Sometimes it's fun and sometimes it's really frustrating that over and over and over again we have to be reminded of that and relearn it again that it is by the grace that we can stay step. And, I can hear it 20 times in a day, and then I go off and I'm doing something else and get all caught up in the illusion again.
Mm-hmm. It seems like most of the time I try to do things so that I can be in relationship with God rather than do things out of a relationship to God.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really crucial for me to respond out of God's love in that relationship, which is the only real thing that we've been talking about, because God has created us for a relationship with Him. And out of that love, we respond by doing, rather than the other way around, by doing so we can get close or to improve our relationship. That really is the key for me.
Luther had a way of saying it, and this isn't his words, but when grace comes, all the games are over. And you really don't have anything left to do except to be what you're created to be. And that is in nature and trusting God. Luther had an interesting way of talking about anxiety. He said that after the fall, the human jumped at the rustling of a leaf. That nature is just terror.
Oh, without the fall, we're madmen all.
I guess my main question is, does this touch your, does this touch something at the core of your being? I don't know how to answer that question. Yeah. Chair then, Jim.
It does, because it reminds me of two of powerful, one is the title of a movie we saw several months ago, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. And the other one is, I guess it's Tilke who writes about us being separated from God. He calls God other names. My interpretation would be just the anxiety and restlessness we live with, we're separated from God. And that maybe grace comes in the form that I'm not as separated as I think, or if I give away some of the illusions I pursue so intensely.
Yeah.
Separation.
The Saint Augustine quote has so much power because we have a longing emptiness, and the all of the consumerism, militarism, power. Everything we see around us is, once you see this, you see that as the pitiable human being seeking to fill that emptiness. And the faith statement is that emptiness is there to be filled in a love relationship with God. And when that doesn't happen, then the human being just goes almost insane trying to fill that in some other way. And as Niebuhr says in that, builds anxiety upon anxiety. Jim.
I'm slightly exasperated with the flavor of what you gave, because it sounds so decent and well-washed and quite Unitarian things, which I attended in Minneapolis for a short time in my journey between Protestant churches. And the Unitarians is almost like going there and having a nice editorial from the New Republic read to us every Sunday. And all people were equal, and all the world was kind of a slightly homogenized milk of human kindness. The ancient Greek and Roman world said there were special wrinkles in time where the sphinx and the sibyl dwelt, and you went to these sacred springs for wisdom. And Christianity took that over with places where there were special miracles and saints had a special arbor or place where they dwell. The world was not all equal, and in the Old Testament, Jews felt they were a people set apart. And when God set you apart, he also made you a victim. And the world was a very exciting place, and the ancient Puritans felt there were special places of evil, and it's not all an evenness. You're something like a decent economist who says, let's consider every leaf a $5 bill. And of course, it's very attractive. We have our baskets full in a hurry, but they buy absolutely nothing. And in a world of great terror and warfare and fanaticism, what kind of armor does that give you to withstand this dreadful age? We know what Luther and his group did, some things we don't quite approve of, but they were powerful men and women. This seems like a kind of a weak tea where you've dipped the tea bag 28 times. So finally, there's hardly anything left but the faint hint of, ah, there was once something in this cup.
I think I'd have two responses to that, one personal and then also relating to the terror of this world. I don't think you're understanding me if it sounds like something that's placid. I'm talking about my death of all of my illusions, which is wrenching and painful, and it's not over. You know, if I've communicated in any way that this is kind of a little easy, simple answer, I'm talking about the terror of dying to things that I grasp on to, hold on to. I'm talking about the birth pangs, I think is the best word of entering into life with God. Secondly, Luther said, but he never quite caught what he said. I think that's one thing you might be referring to, that once we're free of these illusions, and I think I'd rather almost put it in process terms, you know, when we're being freed or unclutched from these illusions, the more we're unclutched, the more then we're free to love. And I'm convinced that, for example, the nuclear arms race, why do so few people care about the nuclear arms race? Because it's part of this vast world that we can't control, that's so out of control. You know, once when I'm free from the need to somehow control it and solve it, then I'm also free to enter into that world. And that's part of the world that then I can bite, embrace. Am I making sense?
Dan, I was always curious about the other perspective of it, the so-called secular perspective, the Marxist perspective that the illusion is not the world, the illusion is God.
You analyze anything from your own perspective.
Yeah.
You know, we'd say both Marxism and capitalism and all would be part of the illusion of human.
Isn't that curious though, that that each illusion accuses the other illusion? An illusion.
Yeah, and it's again, it brings us back to the fright of faith, that you jump in, take that leap, yeah, without any definite proof. Jump into the water.
I'm not sure I still understand all of Jim's comments. Did it seem like the absence of power Or did it seem like it didn't look at the world with its terror? Or are you calling for holy places? And I heard three things and I'm not...
Taking fairly literally the word humus, where somehow all the world is equal and God is equally powerful in all spots, which is in a sense attractive. At the same time, it becomes, in terms of our ancestry in the past, such a weak kind of thing, where there is not this sense of a special model. Christ as man who came on earth as the most unusual man that ever lived, and the stern sense of doctrine that gave the people to carry on in the face of immense disaster. And I just can't see very many people following us. It takes a special kind of I think, middle class, educated, suburbanite, with the very nice comforts of medicine and money to kind of sit in this kind of humility. It just doesn't seem like a strong doctrine to me. It is similar to Quakers, it's similar to Buddhists, it's similar to Zen, it's similar to Unitarians, but it doesn't seem similar to those stalwart Lutherans and Baptists that defied kings. It doesn't seem to me to be the way Paul himself was.
Yeah. I guess that's where I don't know what leads you to see what Dan said as being a kind of quiet equality. I understand what you're saying, but it doesn't seem different from what Dan said. That's where I don't. Yeah.
I get part of it is, I mean, this isn't. These sessions have not been sessions on standing up to the powers of this world. These sessions have, as I see them, have been on the painful existential, if you want to use that word, terror of the human being facing death. You know, and I strongly disagree with you that the implications would carry you up, what I've said,
you seem
would
more,
carry you in, let
you
me finish.
You seem more emotionally moved by sexist language like him or his than you were by death, which on stylistic grounds is irritating to me. I would like it, Holden, for a lot of that to be knocked off, for a man to go ahead and use his and for a woman to go ahead and use her, and let's not apologize every time we're reading an ancient document. It's quite irritating to me. It shows a pretty niceness, which it seems like perfumed lavender leaves every time you open your mouth on that subject, and I wish you wouldn't do it. Stylistically, it's irritating where you show more emotion about the nature of language than the life and death matters you're discussing.
I think what Jim is saying is it's not necessarily this particular session, but it's kind of a reflection of all of Holden. That at times we... at times, it's very easy to talk about putting our Christian faith to work and being strong and stalwart and standing up to the powers of the world. And quite another thing when we leave Holden, or quite another thing applying Holden to the world. And is that what I'm getting, sort of?
Well, of course, I'll have some friendly opponents here, but I just don't think inclusive language should be high on our agenda. I just think it should be one of the...
I guess I need to say, and I wouldn't be... I need to say I'm irritated if you aren't hearing that I face my death with a lot of terror and need to grasp more and more every day under the grace of God. And I'm... You know, it's irritating to me when another person, you know, says what's inside of me. We're all irritated when another person feels like he or she knows what's going on inside of me. And so that's why I just have to say that I'm deeply concerned about language, but the deepest existential question that I have is my own aging, my own death and what is life going to be about before that death. I guess maybe I'm overreacting to feeling like I've been accused of being shallow. And I don't want to over grasp onto that because I'm not that.
Somehow maybe I'm getting in touch with Jim a little bit. I like some better equipment with which to rail against death. And I can't quite get any because I don't think there really is any. And I wish there were. And so I'm going to fight against the nuclear powers or some other principalities and powers to rail against my own death.
What I think this has brought up, that as a community we need to talk some more about the language issue, because it's, again, needs to have a good open community discussion.
And we, the mortality rate is 100%. We can't control that, but we can control our language. That's significant for me in life here and now.
Well, it seems I'll add to high schools that can't teach Huck Finn because it has Nigger Jim in it, and all over the country that's being outlawed. I think that's the direction we're going. That every time we find a so-called sexist language, it's like a Nigger Jim. So you can't use the book in high school or college if this was the implication of the thing, which seems to me folly.
Jim, you made the comment that you talked about life and death matter. I think language is a life and death matter in that our language says what's inside of us. It's a symbol of our prejudices and our values. And indeed, racist language, to call someone a nigger, says a lot more than, sure, black people can live where they want to live or whatever. Nigger has a whole lot of connotations with it. When we talk about all of us as being male, that's expressing a prejudice. It's expressing an enculturated value that lies within all of us. It is a life and death matter.
Oh, I don't think so. We have lived with quirky language for 4,000 or 5,000, 10,000 years now. Sometimes they do a little harm, most of the time it doesn't do any harm.
To you? You're a white male, Jim.
Let's be specific. Would you outlaw Huckleberry Finn, or would you like to rewrite it?
I can answer that. Dr. Lee had the kids, the college students, young adults, read Huckleberry Finn when they were up here in January. And they talked about everything. And it was a good study. So, and the point was, there was a whole lot of things about race in that book, and they discussed them all. I wonder if you noticed that I used inclusive language at my matins this morning, and it was a lot of work to do that. It's a lot of work. I did a lot of erasing, striking out, writing over, but I bet you didn't even notice that I did it. But I'll bet that if I hadn't done that, that every woman who's been at Holden more than a month would have noticed. And a lot of men, too. It's hard to do that, and I've had.
I much prefer we get back to Dan's point of the central issue of the day. I consider this not an important issue, but it was just on stylistic grounds. I didn't like the way you apologized all along the way. I don't think a man should apologize. Just go ahead and quietly reform, but never apologize.
I guess I don't understand where.
You said, I apologize for the sexist language here, but go ahead and read it anyway. Just go ahead and read it. Don't always apologize. That's just stylistically groveling like a little unnecessary worm.
Jim, I've chosen to do that, and I will continue to do it. You know, and you have to, I'll accept you, but I've chosen to do that. Okay. Anybody else? Should we have coffee?